You are listening to the Power of Why podcast.
I think it's fair to call it an investment because when you hit hard times, your belief gets pummeled. So you have to work hard to bring yourself back up to the point where your belief in yourself is where it was before you got pummeled. So that 100% is belief, and it continues to this day. I mean, I've been in tech and I've been a songwriter. Why the heck do I think I can write a book? Well, I did it. Right?
You did.
Mm-hmm. So that's belief. It's a lonely thing when you go after your dreams. You, even if you have supporters, which I have tremendous support, but your supporters don't do the work for you.
Right.
You have to do the work. And so that certainly takes a tremendous amount of commitment, and the commitment is fed by belief.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Power of Why podcast. My name is Naomi Hailey, and today we are here with Susan Odle. Susan, how are you doing today? Welcome to the show.
Terrific, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so happy that you're here. I know that today's conversation is going to be super in-depth, and I hope that the audience is really able to see themselves in your story and kind of walk away with some really great lessons as well. I wanted to give the audience a bit of a background. So Susan's lived a life. reading your book, it brought me, like, I had a lot of moments of like deep breaths, just like going through all of the work that you've done over your career, and also just your personal life as well. The reflections that you've shared in this book are real, and they're plain, meaning like they were very clear to read. And what that tells me is just the amount of time and reflection that went into being able to articulate it so clearly to us. And so I just really commend your sense of focus and your intentionality in putting out a book and capturing a lot of your career online as well.
I really appreciate that, Naomi. Thank you.
Yeah. So over a 27-year career, Susan Odle has had a significant role in the lives of leaders through hands-on transformational change. Susan works with people to help them identify what is blocking growth, what is blocking profitability and operational efficiencies. And she works to align leadership teams on change that sustains desired results. And through her book, Successful Change, which you will find here, and her latest entrepreneurial venture, 80/20 CS, you've really tested and documented a model that organizations can use to reinforce sustainable change. You've seen a lot in the tech scene. You've led global channel teams, held VP operational roles, worked for PE teams, and founded 3 advisory agencies, and so much more. Susan is also a board member of the Ottawa Music Industry Coalition. She's recognized as one of the top 50 women in SaaS, software as a service, in 2020 by the Software Report. And over her career, Susan has played the long game, which is all about impact and positively contributing to the lives of others. And so thank you for being here, Susan. I'm really, really excited to delve in deep with you. And I would love for you to start with your origin story.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, your introduction was tremendous. It covers a lot of ground, and it's validating because I think I'm at the point in my career where I was able to tell the story that I've told in the book and present myself to market the way that I do now. But I was born in England and definitely raised very British. I'm mixed race, so I have African, Indian, and European roots. And so lots of elements coming into who I am. But if you asked me how I identify, I absolutely identify as British Canadian. My parents were born in Guyana, South America, and I had quite a conservative upbringing. Went to a Christian private school for years. It was not a good experience for me. You know, the sort of judgment and oppression and control was, I rebelled against it. I was definitely not the compliant child, but that's just a creative streak in me of, you know, not being bound to a defined box. So I had a really happy childhood. Everyone has struggles, good parents, just different perspectives on life. So, yeah.
What was, I always love asking the question, like, were you encouraged to color outside of the lines or stay within them? You hint a little bit in your response, but I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely was not encouraged to color outside the lines. I think when you come from an immigrant experience, so I'm an immigrant to Canada. My parents leaped 3 continents and we finally ended up in Canada. You're under a certain amount of pressure to conform in order to get ahead, right? You sacrifice a little bit of the freedom in order to, you know, open doors, and you can judge that or not, but that's the way it was. And I think to some degree it is, but so no, I was definitely raised with stay in the boundaries. And if you do, you know, you're going to be okay. And I think I definitely subscribe to that to a degree. But where I felt the need to color outside the line or break through the line and paint my own mosaic, I've done it 100% my whole life. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you describe to us your journey coming to Canada? I know you were raised in Toronto. Now you call Ottawa your home. How old were you, and what was that transition like coming to a new place? And
I was about 6 and a half when I came to England, to Canada, I should say. I have, you know, definitely a few memories of England that I treasure. You know, those formative years from birth to 6 and a half defines who you are. And that's why I do say that I'm British Canadian. My life here was good. You know, growing up in Southern Ontario, Pickering, just outside of Toronto, small town next to a big city. So having that big multicultural experience and opportunity, you know, was massive. I did leave the GTA to come to Ottawa for school to get away from the religious sort of dome that I was experiencing there and to break free. And so I've moved back to Toronto, moved back to Ottawa. I had my daughter on the West Coast, so I've seen, you know, different experiences within Canada. But Ottawa is just an amazing city. It's like this happy medium of everything Canada has to offer. And I've called it home for the last 17 years, 18 years. And this is where I will be home for the rest of my life. Yeah. So I've gone where I've needed to go. I've experienced a lot. I've even owned a retail business on the West Coast for a while because that's what made sense at the time. Lots of experience and just going where opportunity and adventure has taken me.
Yeah. And I think there's a beauty in not necessarily thinking that the traditional path is the only path that you have in front of you. And I think that type of thinking, and you talk about it in the book, the successful change mindset. Can you talk a little bit about your entry into tech? From my understanding, you read about it in a newspaper and were like, okay, I need to enter this space. But what was the early part of your career entering into the tech scene, and how did you kind of use your successful change mindset to build the career that you have today?
So I've always been around tech, and I will thank my father for this forever. He's passed away, but he was always into whatever the latest gadget was. And so he lined up at Radio Shack to buy the first VIC-20 computer, which was the first home computer accessible to, you know, middle-class, working-class families. So I've always been around tech. And so when I was reading the Toronto Star, there was this article that came out talking about this new industry that was just booming, tech. And I'm like, I can do that. Here I am. I was actually the top sales rep in a high-end furniture store in Toronto. You know, in terms of furniture sales, it was like the premier kind of job, but boring as all hell, right? Like you have nothing to do until a customer walks in the door. And that just wasn't enough for me. So I just thought I can do that. So I started applying for jobs with no credentials in order to get a job in tech. And I didn't give up. I just kept applying. And I finally got a call from a company called Centrifax. And it was two ex-executives from Rogers that had started up a little company to do fax on demand surveys. So like the early days of automation where you'd color in the little ballot boxes and it would scan it and produce an automated report for surveys and things like that. And so they offered me a job straight commission, not a penny in salary. And I walked away from my salary job because I knew I wanted to be in tech because I was interested in technology and I had confidence that I could use my retail and banking sales experience in tech. And so I worked my way up from not a penny in salary to, I think my first salary job was $1,250 a month in salary. And I just worked my way up and produced results until I made the decision to come back to Ottawa and got my first software job with a company called OmniMark Technologies. And great experience, an amazing group of people that I worked with there that have gone on to do some massive things. And I've just kept my nose down, worked hard, built trust, taken on new challenges, produced results, which inspires your leadership to give you more challenges. And you just keep knocking it out of the park with quality and performance and commitment and dedication. And it's the long game. Like when I think about my first software job, that was 24 years ago.
Wow.
And here I am now, right? But that's, you better be passionate about what you're doing if you're going to sustain that level of performance and curiosity and drive over that many years. It's got to be something you really enjoy doing.
In your book, you have a lot of great statements that I'm definitely going to call to throughout this conversation. Sure. But you say overnight success is fiction. And I think by what you just said, the level of just dedication to your craft, really, demonstrating results, knowing the right people, being able to like communicate what those results are as well. From sales to moving into operations and really getting to a place where you have been able to offer a very like specialized expertise.
Right.
For folks who maybe are generalists right now, but are interested in specializing and being known for one thing, let's just say, how did you develop that craft?
That's a great question. So I am a generalist. I'm just a senior generalist, right? Mm. So my career started off carrying a direct sales bag, and then it moved into distributed sales. So channels, distribution agencies, those types of partners. And then I've been an entrepreneur. 80/20 CS is actually venture number 4. So right. I, when you operate your own business, you are finance, you are marketing, you are sales, you are delivery. And so being in operations, VP of operations, and my last role, COO of BDO Lixar, that is not a functional operations. It's not, people think about operations as being looking at reporting around performance and metrics. Operations from a technology point of view is holistic. And so if you haven't performed in multiple functions, how can you possibly know what's going on to a certain degree in a particular function? You can't. So my success as an operations lead has been because I've performed in sales, I've performed in professional services, I've performed in channels, I performed in being a hack in marketing as an entrepreneur, because I would not at all call myself a marketing expert, but I've been a hack because I run my own business and I understand finance because I've operated businesses. And so I need to understand P&L every year, year over year. So the best operations people are the people that have sat in the shoes of people that they are leading or people that they are giving guidance to. You're not speaking the same language if you haven't lived it. So I think it's a great question, because being a generalist is huge. If you have an ambition to advance your career, or if you have an ambition to start your own business, that broad experience is critical. It's really, really important.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that when you first started, or how did you navigate?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. I think I can't say enough about the people that have given me opportunities over my career. It's not because it's like a handout, because I don't believe in those, but based on the potential that they saw in me, backed up by a result. So when I started in sales, I thought I would remain in sales. And then I'm definitely somebody that gets bored. When something becomes rote, I lose interest in it. I'm not happy to just take a paycheck to do the same thing over and over again. So I've had the opportunity, like at OmniMark, where Mark Godby, our VP of sales at the time, decided OmniMark needed to have a channel strategy. And he's like, do you want to take that on? So I went and I took a number of courses in channel management from respected organizations. And we started up the channel and drove revenue through the channel. I think the hard work that produces evidence of progress, that then produces results, that trail of evidence is critical. And when you do that, people will notice, and then they will trust you to take on new opportunities that you may not be qualified on paper to take on. Like, I am not qualified on paper to do much of what I've done, but I've got a track record of trust and a track record of evidence that gives people confidence that I can do things that I may not have done before. And so that's been my narrative my entire career.
This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Invest Ottawa, Ottawa's lead economic development agency for knowledge-based industries, and with critical support of the title sponsor of International Women's Month, BDC Capital's Thrive Venture Fund, we teamed up to produce this special podcast series to celebrate women leading in Ottawa. In support of its Women Founders and Owners strategy, Invest Ottawa offers programs and services that enable and accelerate the growth and success of women entrepreneurs from every walk of life. Visit www.investottawa.ca/women to learn more. There's that one point where you talk about earning this moniker of fixer and coming to a point where you realized, okay, this is what I'm known for in my network. And there are a few decisions that you can make, you know, reject it, maybe if you have other ideas of what you want to do, and or lean into it and say, okay, like, I'm going to maximize what I'm like naturally good at and what I'm known for. And so you decided to do the latter. What has been critical for you to kind of lean into your gifts?
That's a great question. You know, I didn't even know the fixer thing was a thing until I would say maybe 3 years ago, someone mentioned it to me. And I'm like, I looked back and I'm like, yeah, actually that's true. Like, even going back to 1990, I'm going to say 97, where I was pulled in to turn around. I was asked to take over a channel team that was just driving trickling revenue. We needed it to be a lot better. And that's sort of the first instance of Jan Kaminski saying, you know, can you take this team over and make it happen? And we reorganized everything we were doing and produced amazing results in 18 months. I'm going to say that was 1999, actually. That was my first real fixer accomplishment, but I wasn't aware of it. I just kept working, and you know, C-suite members and at a few occasions a board members would call me and say, like, can you come and help this company? You'd be perfect in this role. And I would just go and do it, and then I would fix a problem, and then I would be bored, and so it's time to move on to the next problem. And that's been the way things have gone. But the fixer attachment didn't happen until the last few years in terms of me hearing it. So I'm absolutely leaning into it. You know, I'm good at it. I don't know why, but I might be the music background. I don't know, but I have the ability to see patterns in a business, patterns in an operation, and then hone into those variances in the melody, if you like, and amplify the things that are working and fix the things that are broken. And I also get along really well with people. I don't see hierarchy. So I think people are people at every level. And so that combination of just being able to have an open mind, see trends, and then bring people together to take action on it really efficiently. That's my secret weapon, that combination of things. So I'm 100% leaning into it because I'm good at it and I enjoy it. More importantly, I enjoy the work. I enjoy the challenge.
I really like that metaphor that you've painted around like connecting your music background and with the work that you do as well. You alluded to 80-20, just around like maximizing like the things that work, mitigating what isn't working for a particular business. So could you share with the audience a little bit about why you started this latest venture?
Absolutely.
And the concept behind the name and the work you do.
Yeah. So 80-20 CS, it's six letters and numbers that mean a heck of a lot. The book's origin story, I was working for the PE firm out of the US, and we had a QBR that left me feeling frustrated that you know, there were alternatives to some decisions that we made, but given the environment, and I'm not blaming the PE firm, that was their business model was to hit certain metrics. And I knew that going in, but it's like, do I want to participate in this type of a business environment anymore? And I decided, no, I don't. So how would I do things differently? So I remember sitting in my office and thinking, okay, what is it that's made me successful in my career? What are my personal attributes that have really aided my career? And so the CS in 80/20 CS stands for core strength. Mm-hmm. And core was the first thing I came up with when I was imagining the book. Core is an acronym that stands for confidence. I'm a very confident person. I have a lot of confidence in myself to take on challenges, take on new things, and see things through. I'm very open to new opportunities and new adventures and new challenges. I am absolutely resilient. It's in my blood from generations way back. Mm-hmm. It's in my DNA, and I work hard. I've been working since I was 13 years old, and I enjoy work. So C stands for pretty important things in my experience of being successful. And then the S is a measure of core. And mm-hmm. in the book, there's a scoring model for those things. And so, and then 80/20 CS is the Pareto principle. Other people know it as the 80/20 rule. So it is about focus. What are the 20% of things that you should be amplifying? And what are the 20% of things that you should be mitigating, and those things that have a multiplier impact on whatever you're doing? And so the blueprint and the model, it's applicable to your personal life as well as it is to your business life. It's a mindset model. It's about alignment, and it's about buy-in. And yeah, so the 3.5 years of writing the book was going from that initial acronym of CORE to building the framework, and then realizing, okay, there's a bazillion frameworks out there. Like, that's not exciting. And then how do you write a narrative around it that people feel connected to? And that's really the journey that took some time.
Yeah, I loved it. I haven't finished the book yet, because I really think it, I don't think it's a book that you just kind of like read once really quickly. It's something that you will consistently reference. You call it a guidebook of sorts. And so, you know, for those who are interested, there are a lot of case studies, and Susan does a great job breaking down problems that she's helped leaders solve in the past and how they've been able to work through it. And I like how you mentioned that it can be used for your personal life as well. I'm wondering if you're open to it. If you're not open to it, it's all good. But I would love if you could like walk us through how to practically go through the gates. You have five gates that you've outlined.
Absolutely. So I'm happy to share a personal, and obviously it's going to be retrospective because the book was written in the last 3 years, but I'm happy to share a personal story about how it would have been helpful to give me some guidance at a challenging time in my life. But as I mentioned, the blueprint, the 80/20 CS blueprint, it's a tool, and it is something that you can go back to and refer to. But I think if people apply it enough, it'll become just a part of their mindset. It's about adopting this successful change mindset. It's all about alignment. It's all about buy-in. And it gives people a repeatable way to work through how they're going to approach capturing an opportunity that's important mm-hmm. to them, something that's like an ambition, that's something they have a vision for, or how are they going to work through a problem that they need to solve? And again, in your personal life or in a business environment. And more importantly, when you have an opportunity you want to go after or a problem you want to solve, but you need other people to participate in those things, then alignment and buy-in is important if they're going to be with you and not, you know, steer things off the beaten path. So it helps people fail fast and start again. It helps people feel validated that they're on the right path through this buy-in model. So, you know, gate one. Again, whether it's personal or business, what are you asking to change? And how quickly can you articulate that? So in sales, we talk about an elevator pitch. That's universally applicable in life. If you're trying to accomplish something, you need to be able to communicate based on the homework you've done in mm-hmm. preparation for presenting an ask. You really need to be able to nail that. Number two, if you were to succeed at that ask, what's the payoff? What's the ROI that you're going for? That needs to be something that you can measure Gate number three is all about the strategy, your execution strategy. What are the things that you're going to do? Not tactical, but what's your approach? When are you going to do it? Where are you going to do it? How are you going to do it, right? And then gate four gets into the tactics. What are my time-bound milestones that I'm going to commit to? What am I going to get done today? What am I going to get done this week, this month, that's going to support this strategy, that's going to deliver this ROI? And then gate five is really your sustainability plan. Like, how are you going to ensure that you don't fall back to the old habits that got you into the problem in the first place? Or if you're doing something new, how are you going to protect that thing and nurture it along so it succeeds long term? So it's really all about buying in, and through all of the gates, there is a scoring model, as I mentioned earlier, that lets you scratch beneath the surface of people who say, yes, I'll do it. How bought in are they really? So that you can dig into mitigating risk early and not going, you know, from gate one to gate four, and you think that everything's solid, but truly right. Only 40% of the people are truly bought into it. So it's very pragmatic. And so mapping it back to a personal, I went through a pretty difficult divorce when my daughter was 18 months old, and it lasted a couple of years. And as somebody who's trying to maybe leave a difficult marital situation, they have to think about their finances, their economic situation. What's their path to independence? You know, what if they don't have their economic profile is going to change? How are they going to take care of themselves? And if they have children involved, after they go through that divorce, like even in that scenario, thinking about, okay, why are you leaving? Have you really thought through why you're leaving? What's your goal? Do you want to be gone in 6 months? Do you have a 2-year horizon that you're going to have to be systemically, you know, changing your situation strategically? What is your strategy for where you're going to go? You know, how you're going to reestablish yourself? Maybe your plan is to move back to where your family is more concentrated, so you have more support. You know, in my case, I don't have family here in Ottawa. So I've had to kind of figure things out as a solo mom since my daughter was two. And, you know, it's been a ride, but you need to be pragmatic. So I'm naturally wired to think this way. And what I've done in the book is I've documented it.
Yeah.
You know, this like long game pragmatic approach to thinking through what you're trying to accomplish, and then systematically taking those long game steps, you know, fully. It almost took 10 years to come through the difficult relationship breakup situation. It's a long game, but you got to be steady. And so I think this framework, that's coming out of a problem. But if you are an individual who has a personal goal, maybe you want to release an album. Okay, great. Do you know how to play an instrument? Okay, even if you don't, maybe you're a lyricist and then you team up with a musician that can co-write with you. So still, you know, what's the ask? What's your goal? What's your strategy? What's your time frame? It's universally applicable, but obviously from a monetization point of view, for my career, yeah, it's really focused on the business front.
You go through two main case studies, but there are several like stories in the book. I'm wondering, when it comes down to saying yes or no to a particular opportunity, and maybe you could paint your response with the various decisions that you've made along your career, whether it was you've like started three advisory agencies, yeah, whether you were saying yes to going into an organization to solve a particular problem. How did you know that this was going to be either a career elevating move or an opportunity to build to your portfolio of experiences, yeah, and expertise? What have been like some really great and fascinating problems that you've been able to work through?
Yeah, so every time I've walked away from one of my advisory firms, it's because there's been an executive or board member that has asked me to come back and come in full time and help them really be a strong member of the team. And so if the problem set is interesting enough for me that I know that I would not be bored in that role, it's hard to say no to people that have been your advocates and your trusted allies in business for a long time. So that's, you know, that's where this, again, being identified as a fixer and then looking back and going, oh yeah, I guess I was, because that's what I've been doing. So the reason for the jumps in and out of self-employment are totally related to being pulled in to solve a problem on a full-time basis, solving that problem, and now going out and helping more companies on a one-to-many basis, and just that sort of up and down pendulum of problem solving. Mm-hmm. But in terms of one of the most interesting and complex opportunities or problems or collaborations that I've been through, I would say 100% it's the EBITDA turnaround that I had to deliver within a year in an M&A scenario as well. So we had a very short window of time to significantly improve the bottom line. And I was brought in specifically to do that. So now I'm dropping in cold into a large organization where I have to build relationships and establish trust and then reorganize, re-engineer how we function in order to turn bottom line around. Mm-hmm. That was daunting, but we succeeded to the benefit of many, many families. And I'm very proud of that. But the complexities of being new to an environment, the pressure of building trust and building credibility, the trust the founders put in me to do that, also making sure I delivered the benefits to the acquiring organization. So when you look after turnarounds of the bottom line, there's also an integration that needs to happen between two organizations. And so multidimensional, very complex. So I'm very proud of that situation. I would say that was the most, it could have gone either way, right? You could have had many families that weren't able to realize the benefits that were available to them. And so, complex and very rewarding work.
Honestly, I admire you and your work so much because there are so many moving parts. And I think you've really kind of explicitly shared what those are just in the example that you just talked about.
Right.
Building trust, building relationships, getting leaders and also folks on the front line who are operationalizing a change aligned to a bigger vision are no small feats. I'd love to talk a little bit about this building trust aspect. Coming into a new organization, or if an individual is, you know, starting a new role, or they have an idea that they want to bring to life, what have you learned around building trust, and how can people kind of take that mindset into their own world?
Great question. I think, like, I've seen a lot. I've seen a lot of wealth over my career. Like when you've gone through multiple M&A cycles and you've worked for PE firms and you have, as you go up the management ladder, you get exposed to different levels of wealth. And at the end of the day, people are people. They're people are people. It doesn't matter. And so, whether you're in your mid-20s to early 30s, or you're in your 40s and 50s and you're in senior leadership, you have to just be human and be professional, but just treat people like people. Imagine your organization is flat and take an interest in, obviously, if it's a large business, you can't know everybody, but you can know a representative from every function of a business and every level of a business. That's only going to help you succeed as a leader. So I think for people coming up in their career, don't pose. Just be yourself and be open to learning, be open to failure and learn from failure and treat people with respect. And as you move into management and you move into senior management, forget that you're in senior management. Mm-hmm. Just do your job, do the work, servant leadership is an overused term, but I feel like servant leadership is about viewing your organization as a flat thing. And be curious about all of it. And, you know, to me, leadership is about, you have more accountability from a P&L point of view. That's what leadership is. But on a human level, everybody is just who they are. Treat them like that and you'll be amazed what you'll get back in return in terms of the level of motivation of teams and people to move as one unit towards a common goal. Leadership does not work more than ever. I'm Gen X. My daughter's Gen Z. We see the world through very similar lenses. right? And I love Gen Z. I mean, they are very clear on what they want and what they don't want. And I think that leadership needs to embrace that and leverage it, harness it. But if you're not building trust, like more than ever, the generation and the next generation is going to be even more so. You can complain about their autonomy, or you can understand them and build trust and buy in, right? And alignment, all the stuff. It's all connected. It's just about relationships mm-hmm. and trust and respect.
Mm-hmm. The key thing about understanding them, yeah. understanding people. I mean, that's applicable to everywhere, right? But I think a critical part is being curious about people and being genuine about who you are.
I think curiosity and being genuine is just fundamental to being successful in life, period. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not curious, then it's a bit lazy not to be curious. And I know, so, like, I'm naturally curious, not everybody is. If you're not, then you need to work on those skills, because curiosity is what enables you to scratch below the surface of something and understand what lies underneath it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, statistically, 70% of all transformation initiatives fail. And I, even though they've only captured that from a business point of view, I think the same is true on a personal level.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of that is because people just kind of go on the surface of what something is. And it's all the gray stuff underneath the surface that will trip you up at the time when you least expect it. And then it's really hard to recover from that. So, you know, I say this a lot, change management. And what I do is operationalizing change. And that starts from ideation all the way to execution. It's work, right? So do the work early instead of waiting for it to break and then doing a lot of work to scramble and fix it later on. Like, just do the work.
Yeah. And scratching beneath the surface is it's something that needs to be embedded through your process. And I think when you went over each gate, you talk about that. You talk about scratching beneath the surface and digging deeper.
Yeah, that's what the scoring model is all about. Like, is every gate, you're using that scoring model at an individual stakeholder level, right? Mm. You're not just doing it once and thinking that you're fine. You're holding yourself to account. Do I really understand what it is I'm trying to do?
For organizations that are navigating 4 or 5 generations in one place, what is the starting point in terms of understanding who is a part of your team, what drives them, and how we can motivate very different people to get on one accord?
Well, so I do not believe in micromanagement at all. The only thing that matters is measurable progress, which drives results. And so if you, as a leadership team, are focused on providing clear guidance on what the North Star is and how that trickles down to functional units, then let people work how they want, but hold them to account by measuring their progress towards whatever it is they're responsible for delivering. And I think if companies could take that approach, then you have a more flexible way of supporting people in their 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, and 20s. Why does everybody have to operate under the same behavior when they're very different people? Mm-hmm. You know, my daughter said there was a time in her life where she didn't have a device. The only device she had was her little portable DVD player. Like, so she wanted to be like independent on her own thing. She would get a DVD and watch her Barbie movie, right? But like, she's the last generation that is not going to grow up with this sort of digital, this micro computer in your pocket from a very young age. And so people are only going to change more and more. Like, you can't compare somebody that lives in the digital world that we do today, which is going to be way different again in 5 years, and expect them to behave in the workplace the same as somebody like me or somebody in their mid-30s. So we have to recognize the difference in how people are adapting and being raised into this world. And so I think leaders need to focus on measuring progress and producing results and give people the flexibility to do whatever they need to do to get there. I mean, obviously it can't be completely boundless, but I think you can't put everyone in the same bucket behaviorally, because they're not the same. So to answer the first part of your question, in business we have customer advisory boards, CABs, right? Where software companies will go out and pick a representation of customers from around the world to advise product development and go-to-market strategy. I think companies would be well advised to have a generational board within their businesses and learn and make some adaptations based on that.
Yeah,
You
that's
don't
great,
have to
Susan.
sacrifice results for understanding. You can have both. I think that's the challenge of leadership is being open to doing something new. Rigidity in processes and matrix and organizational design is not going to stand anymore. Things are changing way too fast. And so take care of your people and without sacrificing performance, you can do both.
Yeah, and that's something that you talk about a lot, just around not forgetting people, right? Business and people. And there's a case study that you talk about around, and the biggest point that I took away from that was just around losing trust of your teams. And one of the ways you talked about it was through layoffs, actually, and how short-term thinking and kind of like a cheap
Cheap
approach
comes out
is actually
expensive.
expensive.
That's right. And I have to give credit to the People's Court, Judge Milian. She's the one that used to say that it's an expression that's well known in the Latin culture. But it's brilliant, right? And it is. This quick slash and burn to improve the bottom line demotivates the people that are left behind. Really. And so sometimes that has to be done, but this is where I'm very passionate about this. If you are more proactive in managing your business, you can affect change before it comes to that. Now that won't happen successfully in every business because there are factors that can be out of one's control. But I think in many cases, businesses can avoid those types of situations if they just are more proactive about facing a problem head on. And if you don't have the people within your team that know how to resolve it, bring somebody in who can accelerate that with your team. Ego serves no place and benefits no one when you fail. So drop it and just do what you need to do to help.
Looking back on, and we're coming close to the end of the interview, but looking back on like all of your experiences, what you've learned about people and leadership, when you think about where you are today on this new venture and coming out with your book, and what do you most appreciate about where you are right now?
I know I have experienced a lot. Nobody's done everything, but I've experienced a lot broadly and deeply. And so I feel very well positioned to help a lot of people in a lot of different circumstances. And that's exciting for me to be at this point in my career where I have done enough to be a credible and valuable advisor and partner to leaders that want to do something new, whether that's changing a problem or capturing an opportunity. I think that it feels good to have, it feels like a milestone where I have enough experience to document it in a book the way that I've done it. And communicate in it, you said in simple language, like it's a conversation. I wrote the book intentionally as a conversation and for it to feel like we're sitting down and having this conversation together versus an academic dry piece of reading. Yeah, so I feel very grounded in my experience, positive and negative. It hasn't all been glamorous at all. I had to sell a house because of a downturn in my career at one point. But I've learned a lot and I just want to help people. So I feel with 80/20 CS, it's the best entrepreneurial start that I've had in terms of clear vision and value and intent, the intention of what I want to do, which is to help as many people as I can succeed.
And I often say purpose is not attached to any job or opportunity in the way that you've been able to help people in so many different facets of your life is truly remarkable. And I hope people really like truly listen to this conversation, because Susan has a lot of depth to her. And I hope you, you know, grab a copy of Successful Change and see how you can apply it to your own life and what you're navigating. I'm wondering, maybe one of my last questions is, sure, like, what's the best investment that you've made in you? It doesn't have to be financial specifically, but whether it's like time that you've invested in a particular activity or maybe a resource that you've implemented in your life, what's been the best investment?
Hands down, it's belief in myself. Hands down. And you could quantify that, you know, from early days, like 13, I tried to get a job at Burger King and I couldn't get the job because legally you have to be 14 to work. So I worked for my dad for a summer and it was awful, you know, just because working for family is really tough. But I've always had a belief in myself. Mm-hmm. I've always ignored my credentials and just gone after what I'm passionate about. I've always shot higher than my rank. You can only do that. People know, they feel confidence, right? Confidence is not arrogance, by the way, right? Confidence is substantiated in something, some evidence, some experience and know-how. So when you're in your early 20s, you can have confidence and belief in yourself with no experience, and people will support you because of that energy you're bringing and that motivation and that determination. Okay. And when you keep on practicing that investment of belief in yourself, I think it's fair to call it an investment, because when you hit hard times, your belief gets pummeled. So you have to work hard to bring yourself back up to the point where your belief in yourself is where it was before you got pummeled. So that 100% is belief, and it continues to this day. I mean, I've been in tech and I've been a songwriter. Why the heck do I think I can write a book? Well, I did it, right?
You did.
Mm-hmm. So that's belief. It's a lonely thing when you go after your dreams. You, even if you have supporters, which I have tremendous support, but your supporters don't do the work for you.
Right.
You have to do the work. And so that certainly takes a tremendous amount of commitment, and the commitment is fed by belief.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for joining me on the Power of Why podcast. It was an absolute pleasure to meet you and have this conversation. What is the best way for people to support you and connect with you online?
Oh, great. Number one, Naomi, thank you. Your questions were just wonderful. The conversation was broad, and thanks for the opportunity. So best way for people to share the good news, definitely buy the book. It's on Amazon. If you just type in Successful Change, you'll find it. If you know of any leaders, I mentor people one-on-one. My whole business model is extremely flexible. Like, you can literally book me for an hour once in your life, and because I want to help as many people as I can. I have clients of various sizes that I help their leadership teams think through problems. And I'm also a keynote speaker. So if it, you know, to me, if I crystallize it down to if you have a need to think through problem solving or opportunity capture, visit 8020cs.com and just contact me. You can reach me directly at sue@8020cs.com, and I'm happy to chat with anyone. And yeah, that's it.
Amazing. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of the Power of Why podcast. We will catch you in the next episode. Thank you for listening to the Power of Why podcast. You can find the show notes at www.naomihiley.com. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to the Power of Why on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Invest Ottawa and with critical support from BDC Capital's Thrive Venture Fund, the title sponsor of International Women's Month 2024. We've teamed up to produce this special series featuring 6 inspirational leaders. Visit www.investottawa.ca/IWM to learn more.